This is KHOI Community Radio's Local Talk Wednesday edition of COVID-19 Response. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with Pat Schlarbaum. Thanks, Pat, for being here with me this morning as we broadcast together.
Yes, good to be here, Susan.
Yeah, last night when I was listening to the news, I learned that the Tyson plant in Perry reported over 300 cases of coronavirus. Perry, home of the Hotel Petit and Wonderful Arts Festival. I've visited it many times, a bit impressed with how welcoming the business owners and Chamber of Commerce seem to be to Latino citizens. They're an important part of that community. This is one of the towns we keep track of in KHOI, so I'll be following this story during the coming week.
And I know that we'll have a couple of stories about COVID-19 later in the program, but we're starting out on a beautiful note, connecting us to the natural world.
Oh, you must have a special conversation with Carolyn Raffensperger.
Yes, there is. Here's Carolyn. Well, a nice spring shower.
A lovely spring shower. A gentle rain.
A good thing's got to come from a rain like this, doesn't it?
I mean, oh, it does. It does. I was thinking of plants that germinate because of the light, or that are responsive to light for leafing out or for germinating, and others that are responsive to temperature, things that respond to temperature and things that respond to light. You know, the prairie seeds are some of the most amazing seeds. You know, there are some that need to go through the gut of a buffalo. They need that acid before they'll germinate. You know, each seed is dependent on its neighbors, you know, and on specific conditions. And then some other being, you know, the whole timing of the blooming of the prairie and the germination of the prairie, you know, that pollinators are dependent on various species, and that dance of seed and bee and that dance of, you know, the bird and its food. It's just an astonishingly carefully timed rhythm. And I got friends who, in North Dakota especially, that are experts on garden seeds. And I just got a number of heirloom species that come from North Dakota. There are bean seeds that they still grow out that were actually collected by Lewis and Clark. Those seeds have been part of that ecosystem that long. And, yeah, you know, one of the things I was to talk about this morning with you, if you were willing, was what benefit can people be to the ecosystem, to our place? What gifts do we give? We know that we get so many, but what do we give back? What is our contribution to the natural world? And there have been some debates that now humans are so destructive that we have nothing to contribute. We are only takers. Yeah. And I don't accept that. You know, one of the things living here in this pandemic, is to be aware that my breath can be a gift to a plant, and that exhalation is that plants breathe the exhalation of animals, and animals breathe the exhalation of plants. And this is the way it was meant to be, this relationship that we have where we give and receive. And give and receive in equal measure. We cannot take more from the earth than it can regenerate. We cannot put more garbage or waste into the earth than it can absorb. We cannot destroy, you know, entire communities of plants and animals without it coming back to bite us. So the idea that was in my head was, what makes a good neighbor? And I think we're learning a lot during the pandemic about what makes a good neighbor. You know, there have been a lot of questions through the ages about, you know, who is my neighbor? You know, Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan to talk about neighbors. And I think of Wavy Gravy at Woodstock. So Wavy Gravy's up there. people are hungry. It's been cold and it's been wet, and there's been this fabulous music. And at Woodstock, they created granola out of all that oatmeal. They had a lot of oatmeal. They had a lot of other things. And they combined it and fed that entire crowd granola. And Wavy Gravy stood up on that stage and said, "Who is your neighbor? Look to your left and look to your right. That's your neighbor." And when I think about looking to my left and to my right in this moment, you know, what I see are, I saw a hummingbird. I saw a hummingbird
yesterday. Oh, that's a good report. Great. The hummingbirds have returned.
The hummingbirds have returned. Looked, came right up to my window, looked in the window, and, you know, what an extraordinary creature that is, with its rapid heartbeat and its tininess. And here it is, my neighbor. My neighbor is that hummingbird. You know, my neighbor is the blue heron that flew over my house the other day. My neighbor are the, you know, the black walnut and the oaks that are now blooming in the woods. And my next door neighbor, who's a human being, who's, they've got their own struggles and their own ability to contribute. But I've been thinking about what makes a good neighbor, and that our neighbors are not just those humans, although they are, and our survival and our thriving depends on them, but it also depends on those extraordinary other beings with which we share the earth. And so I want to know, what makes me a good neighbor to the wild ones? What do I offer? Sometimes it's my distance, you know, that I don't interfere with the fox who's giving birth. Mm-hmm. I don't interfere with the nesting birds, and that I exercise those good manners, the etiquette of being part of this wonderful, beautiful world.
And through those observations of detail and love, there is a manifestation of sharing and passing those positive messages along. Would that be considered a role in nature, in Carolyn Raffensperger's nature?
Sure, sure. I think the elders have a responsibility to learn that etiquette and to pass it on. You know, every culture has the rules of the road. You know, how do we treat each other, and theoretically, how do we treat the earth? Our culture primarily has rules for relating to technology. So don't text and drive. Our initiation is being 16 and getting your driver's license. And what we've neglected are the rules and the etiquette, the good manners of relating to the natural world, that we're not aware of how much we're taking or how much we're dumping into the earth. We are not aware of the consequences of our behavior. And it seems to me that a morally mature culture would have elders who are well-versed in how we treat the natural world so that the natural world can flourish, and so can we. You know, I think one of the groups of people that often know some of those rules are paradoxically hunters. Regardless of whether you eat meat or not, they're aware of how you treat, they're often aware of, you don't take all the animals, you don't take pregnant animals, you know, if you want the world to go on. You know, so there are things that we learn. We learn that we do not put our waste in the water. So that, talk about coming back to bite you, that really will, in the long run, do harm. And indigenous cultures have developed long-standing practices of how they relate to their place. My good friends, the White Mountain Apache, some of the people I'm closest to are White Mountain Apache, and they anchor their entire history in a place. So all they have to do is name a place, and the entire history of that place is, you know, then known to the listener. And we do a little of that now in our culture. All we have to say is Fukushima or Chernobyl, and we know that there was a massive radioactive waste catastrophe there. You know, we can say Yellowstone, and we know that there's a fabulous national park that has wolves and bison and, you know, just wonderful, wonderful things. And so how we tell our history, how we tell our stories, have become disconnected often from the land. There are a few markers that still connect us. And I think one of the things we can do is tell the stories, even during the pandemic, of what's blooming, how we live in a right relationship with the world, and we'll be better neighbors.
Yeah, this is an opportunity for reflection and introspection, and your topics seem to be very timely for this early part of May. Anything else?
Well, I think the one thing I'd say is that this spring and this rain is the opening of the door of such great beauty, that of all the seasons, spring is, the blooming flowers, and this rain and the red bud outside my window is now in bloom, and that it's a time of recognizing and acknowledging the beauty of the world. And I think it's probably redefining even what we see as beautiful in humans. We're not dressing up to impress, so we can't get a haircut. People are going back to their natural hair color. And we're seeing each other as beautiful, as beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget one time when I was young, in my 20s, and I went to the YMCA, and I saw all the women naked in the dressing room. And I was astonished. The woman who had had a mastectomy, the old, old woman with folds of skin, and the young girls. And I could not get over how beautiful we were. How beautiful we were. We are. And we need to live up to that beauty. We need to live up to the beauty that humans can be. And remember that we have a contribution to make to the natural world, to each one of our neighbors, our human neighbors, our hummingbird neighbors, our walnut neighbors.
Well, you certainly have a contribution to share on this day. And I appreciate listening to your place, where wildness seems to be abounding.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah. I hope to make it always welcome.
Yeah.
Bed and breakfast for the wild.
Oh, they're okay.
My house.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've been listening to Carolyn Raffensperger's reflection on listening to the natural world and becoming a bed and breakfast for hummingbirds and other neighbors who may join us for breakfast. The only thing is, this was for a rainy morning, but we have the benefits of rain as we look out. I'm looking out and seeing the grass and the blooming trees, and yes, it's spring.
Yes, it is, Susan. And it was certainly a nice shower yesterday morning when we recorded, Carolyn.
Yes. Well, our next story is from Veronica Fowler at the ACLU, which has made a request for records of how Iowa prisons are protecting or not inmates and staff. I spoke with her yesterday about what difference these records will make. The ACLU has filed a request for information from the governor's office. Is that right?
Yes.
So what is all this about?
Basically, what we were doing is filing information, and it's not just with the governor's office, it's also with the Iowa Department of Corrections, asking for records and the ability to inspect or look at copies of different records regarding COVID-19 infection risk and spread among people living and working in Iowa Department of Corrections facilities. Those are basically, for the most part, our state prisons.
So do you have any reports at all about what kind of COVID-19 rates they have?
Well, we are getting bits and pieces. For example, there have been some inmates and some staff that have been tested and found positive, and those have been reported. But we want to find out more than just the very basic numbers. We are wanting to see what kind of conversations have gone on around the risk of spreading COVID-19, what actions should be taken, what kind of inputs they are getting from medical professionals in managing COVID-19 in DOC facilities. And we also want to look at any complaints or grievances or requests filed at these facilities, especially as they regard hygiene, protective equipment, medical treatment, all of those sorts of things. We basically want to see what our state prisons and correctional facilities are doing to protect inmates and staff and the surrounding communities from the impact of COVID-19.
Well, are there any visitors allowed?
Right now, no. There are no visitors allowed. There may be certain provisions made for people with visiting attorneys. But even then, I can't imagine that they would be doing face-to-face right now.
Well, I have a question. I visited a friend in one of the prisons in Iowa, mm-hmm. and I learned they didn't give them soap or shampoo, that they had to buy it with the money that they earned from, I'm not quite sure what they did, little menial tasks, right. which they were paid $1 an hour or something like right. that. Do I have those details right?
Well, certainly we have heard a lot of complaints about the ability of inmates to get masks, which is ironic since the state has put inmates to work making masks. So it's very concerning when we hear reports that they aren't being given masks. And certainly we're hearing concerns and complaints about the little bit of social distancing that could take place and a lack of hand sanitizer being available to people. And also, yeah, just basic hygiene materials as well. So certainly we are hearing a lot of complaints, and your friend's experience is not surprising to hear about.
So what do you hope to have as an outcome from this information?
Well, we hope that the government will request or will fulfill our request, and so that we can look at this information and sift through it, see what trends, make sure that the government is behaving properly and appropriately, and that they are doing the best job possible to prevent an even broader statewide infectious disease outbreak.
Is there any concern about the staff going home at night?
Yes, of course. They also, it's very difficult for staff often to socially distance, and they are going to their homes in the evening or in the morning or whenever their shifts are. And just like medical personnel, they would have a concern about spreading it to other people in their household or anyone else that they come in contact with.
Do you have any statistics on the number of cases in the towns near the prisons?
No, we don't have that. We don't have that data.
Will that be something you'll get?
Well, I think we're looking more at what the Department of Corrections is doing within the facility, the area in which it has control, because obviously the Department of Corrections would not have control about surrounding communities. So we're trying to make sure that the government is doing what it needs to do to protect people in our state.
And is there any racial breakdown in this?
Well, yes. We are finding both in Iowa and statewide that people of color disproportionately are being diagnosed and are dying. And unfortunately, that also doesn't come as a surprise, because it seems that whenever there's a crisis like this happening, it's always the most vulnerable populations who are disproportionately impacted. Low-income people, older people, people with physical disabilities, and definitely in this situation, it has a disproportionate racial impact. We just got some information from the Iowa Department of Public Health with the percentage of cases reported so far. White people make up about 91% of the Iowa population, and they are making up about 52% of the cases. Black people make up 4% of the population. They're making up almost 13% of the illnesses. Asian people, 3% of the population, 9% of the cases. And Latino people make up just a little over 6% of the population. They account for almost 25% of the number of cases reported. And that, of course, is directly related to the high number of people in the meatpacking industry who are Latino, and the disturbing reports that we are getting out of the meatpacking plants about people not being able to social distance, not being able to protect themselves from the spread of the disease.
Well, I was thinking that social distancing would be a big problem within prisons. I've seen prisons in other states where they had 5 to 6 people in a cell that was designed for 2 to 4. And of course, even 2 to 4, it's pretty hard to social distance, right?
Right. And the Department of Corrections has tried to reduce its population somewhat, but prior to the COVID-19 crisis, it was, I think it was about 120-some% overcrowded. And now it's, gosh, I'd have to double check the numbers, but now I still think it's like 113% overcrowded. So bottom line, our prisons are still pretty significantly overcrowded, and that makes social distancing and proper hygiene even more challenging.
At the beginning, I heard that there were plans to release nonviolent prisoners. Or is that correct? They're nonviolent?
I don't think it's as simple as violent or nonviolent. I think that the DOC, as we have suggested, look at, first of all, if a person is in a vulnerable population, if that person has diabetes, heart disease, is older, has other health issues, that those people be considered for compassionate release. And then also looking at, for example, anyone who, the parameters we had suggested was that anyone who's going to get out within 1 year anyway, be released now, that they basically be released early. And then in cases where the person is part of a vulnerable population, that person be released 2 years early.
And are those are the only early releases that they have?
Well, those would be early releases. There are others as well. There are other parameters, but those were the broadest parameters we were suggesting.
There were no certain kind of crimes. The person I visited was imprisoned for a repeat drunk driving.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Obviously there's a reason why you send people to prison for that purpose, but it didn't seem to me that, I mean, obviously he couldn't be driving drunk when he was in prison, but other than that, that was his crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly I think the type of crime and how far into it you are and your personal health history are all things that should come into play.
Is there anything else that you hope to accomplish with this lawsuit?
Well, I think basically just holding the government accountable is the bottom line. We need to have transparent government and letting government know that organizations are watching and requesting the information, I think is an important function that organizations like the ACLU can play. This is just a records request, the Freedom of Information Act. So I guess I would add that this is a broader effort that the ACLU and other criminal justice reform advocacy groups are doing. We're also requesting something similar in county jails, that county sheriffs and county attorneys and public defenders work together to release low-risk people who are being held in our county jails as opposed to our state prisons. And especially in our county jails, 87% of the people in county jail are there not because they've been convicted of a crime, but because they're awaiting trial and they just don't have enough money to post bail. So really, they're being held because they're low income, and that just doesn't seem right.
And under these circumstances, it's unnecessarily punitive.
You know, in times like this, it's a prime opportunity for our government to either overreach and impinge on our basic freedoms and rights, or to go the other direction and not do what needs to be done to protect the most vulnerable among us from exploitation and lack of equal opportunity and lack of equal safety in a situation like today.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and you've just heard from Veronica Fowler telling us about the ACLU's Freedom of Information Act request for information about the safety conditions in Iowa's overcrowded prisons. These concerns also extend to county jails.
I read that most of the 10 largest outbreaks of COVID-19 in the United States originated in state prisons and county jails. You may not be able to speak for the prisons, Sheriff Fitzgerald, but what steps are the Story County Jail making to keep its inmates safe?
Yes, and our next guest is our county sheriff. Thank you so much for being with us today. Veronica ended her interview by telling us that 85% of the people in county jails in Iowa have not been convicted of a crime. They're simply waiting for trial and would be temporarily released if they had the money for bail. We wondered what the situation is in the Story County Jail, and we were fortunate that you, Sheriff Fitzgerald, could be with us this morning to answer questions. Thank you for making the time to be with us.
And what we've done in Story County Jail is we started probably about 6 weeks ago. We began by working with the judges, the county attorney, and the other law enforcement agencies in Story County. And our goal was to decrease the number of inmates that we had and to reduce our population. We're doing everything we can to keep the coronavirus out of the jail through sanitation, wiping down workstations multiple times a day. And we have worked to reduce the number of inmates that we have by having those that are nonviolent offenders that also pose no threat to the public, working with the courts and getting those people released. Now, when I say released, that doesn't mean that their sentence or later trials are forgiven. They're just going to be postponed until we're past a threat and we can start to resume some type of normalcy. So anyway, with that being said, usually we have about 86 inmates in the jail. And this morning we have, it's been dropped down to 29 that we have in the jail. And by doing this, that allows us to allow the inmates to do social distancing, and others that are brought into the jail, when that happens, it's they're put into a cell by themselves, and they're quarantined for 14 days. After the 14 days, they are released into the general population if they're still being held.
Well, that sounds like it would be a... It sounds like your way should be way under what your maximum is.
Well, we are way under, but I think it's paid us tremendous dividends. So far, we have no inmates that have symptoms or the virus itself. None of our staff have symptoms or the virus, and none of the other employees in the sheriff's office are demonstrating symptoms, and no one that we know of has the virus.
You haven't done any testing, though. It's not possible?
Well, the governor has their tests that they put out. Individuals can go down if they wish to. I went down last Friday and had my test, and as we were speaking here, I got a text message saying my results just came back now. So when we're done, I'll get on the computer and see what they say about me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that sounds very outstanding, I would say. It's kind of like a model jail. But now, earlier this year, we heard that the Story County Jail had contracted to hold ICE detainees. Have you had any of those coming through?
Since we started reducing the population in our jail, we're not holding any federal prisoners at this point. And at this point, we're not holding any other out-of-county prisoners that we've done for a long, long time. We do have a contract with ICE, and basically that piggybacks off the U.S. Marshals contract under the Department of Justice. And when we hold an ICE inmate, that's an individual who has been charged with a crime, or in some cases convicted and are awaiting deportation. We do not hold inmates strictly on a detainer alone. That puts all kinds of liability on the county. So by not accepting that and only accepting those ICE inmates that have appropriate charges are the ones that we hold. And it would be no different when we hold prisoners for other counties that their jails are overfilled, and we hold their inmates for them while they're awaiting trial or serving out a brief sentence. So everything that we're doing, we're complying with the law. As you know, law enforcement doesn't make the laws. We just carry out the laws that are created by the legislature and then interpreted by the court.
Well, thank you. I think it's no wonder you were so eager to be on today. We had difficulty making all our communications, and Sheriff Fitzgerald really made a big effort to be here. And to so it's great to have a report like that. Thank you so much.
Yes, Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald, this is Pat Schlarbaum. We sure appreciate your service to the county and to the state, of course. I'm curious on the status of your deputies. Are you able to adjust your work schedules to ensure that their outreach doesn't take the COVID-19 virus home to their families?
Well, what we do within the office, those deputies that are out and about throughout the county.
Yes.
That emphasize face masks. They have protective equipment in their vehicles. And should we be going into an area where we know there's a COVID-19 or suspected COVID-19, they'll put on extra protective equipment as they may deem as necessary at that time. As everyone knows, with the COVID-19, whether you would happen to go into a grocery store or shop at a gas station, people that you go by may look healthy, but they could be carriers of the virus itself. Sometimes it's really cloaked in what appears to be a healthy-looking individual.
Oh, I was just hoping to learn your PPE, your protective coverings. Has there been a challenge of securing that type of face masks and things? Do you have adequate supplies in that regard?
Well, right now, I think we do. When this first developed, everyone was in a scramble for PPEs. There's still a lot of places
right.
that are working to obtain PPEs. But right now, what we have to operate with in the sheriff's office in Story County, we have weekly Zoom meetings with all the other law enforcement agencies every Tuesday morning. And we all talk about trying to plan, such as if one department or agency would be, a number of employees would be struck with the virus or the people would have to quarantine at home. We're trying to pool our resources so we can make sure that every area of the county is not going to suffer from law enforcement services. And we'll be working with each other throughout the county through this time to make sure that happens.
And it sounds like you've accomplished the adaptations to get us into this, I guess, about our seventh week of this unfolding story. It's certainly is a challenging enterprise, I'm sure, for the county sheriff, as it is with all
of us.
Well,
it's certainly been a challenge, but I got to give a lot of credit to the other law enforcement agencies throughout Story County. They've all pitched in. We've stopped taking inmates into our jail that are, as I said, nonviolent and are not a threat to the public. And the other agencies have really stepped up and helped with that. And that's what allows us to keep our jail inmate population down so we can have separation within the jail itself.
Well, thank you. That is really an impressive report. Thanks so much for being with us. And
thank you very much. And I hope everybody has a good day. Stay safe and stay well.
Thank you.
Our last guest will be Jan Gammon. telling us about an award won by the Prairie Rivers of Iowa for the interpretive panels on the Lincoln Highway Scenic Byway. But before we talk with her, and a chance to tell our listeners about our next Pantorium session. This evening, here at the KHOI studios, we're having an on-air Pantorium session. Now, typically, we would welcome all the visitors and guests of the Ames area into the front lobby area and have live performances. Of course, with the COVID-19 response, we're pivoting to a new format. Fortunately, a local band, Red's Band, will be featured this evening. They've just released a CD, and we'll be talking about kind of the backstory, if you will, or the what went into the making of this CD with one of the key members, Larry Stoltenberg. The Red of Red's Band will be on hand, and we'll be discussing this work of art and his music, Red's Band's music, at 7 p.m. this evening at the Pantorium session that is going to return. And on Thursday, tomorrow night, May 7th, we're going to have a reprise of some of the greatest hits of the Pantorium sessions. So the Pantorium sessions, our version of live music on air, the public will unfortunately will not be able to attend, but I hope everybody tunes in and learns a lot about Red's Band's new CD, The Healer. And that's this evening at 7 p.m. here at 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.
That's a pretty important announcement. Yeah. Even in this world of social distancing, it's still safe to go outdoors. And one of the things we can do is drive along the Lincoln Highway. Except for seeing the little road signs on the Lincoln Highway, most of us don't know much about it. Our next guest,
Jan Gammon,
is here to fill us in on some of the history and tell us the route. Hi, Jan.
Hello. Thank you for having me this morning. The Lincoln Highway was formed back in 1913, and it travels from New York, Times Square in New York City, to San Francisco. It goes through 13 states, Iowa being one of those. And in Iowa, it's from Clinton to Council Bluffs. And I manage the Iowa portion for the Iowa DOT, and you probably have seen the signs up along the road marking it as such. Back in 1913, there was a group called the Lincoln Highway Association that was formed, and they did promotion of the road, designed the route, and they're the ones that went to the DOT and said, let's make this a byway. So in 2006, it became part of the DOT's byway program. And the DOT puts up those signs that you see on the road. One of the ways we tell the story about the Lincoln Highway is through interpretive panels. And we've created 20 over the past 4 or 5 years. They range from, they're in West Side, Ogden, Jefferson, Scranton, Grand Junction, outside of Grand Junction at the Lions Club Tree Park. In Nevada, we did 2. Tama, there's one. In Montour, there's one. So this past year, we were able to apply or nominate ourselves for an award through the National Scenic Byway Foundation. And this is the first year they're giving these awards out. So we could go back 2 years and talk about the interpretive panels we put in the last 2 years. So it was the one in West Side, the Lions Club Tree Park, Nevada. We did 2. One is about the Jefferson Highway, which intersects with the Lincoln Highway there and runs past their city hall and a new park that's named after both highways. And then the one in Tama was a Eagle Scout project, and that is at on East 5th Street at the Lincoln Highway Bridge Park. Near the iconic Lincoln Highway Bridge that has the words Lincoln Highway spelled out on the side panels. And then the other one we did was in Montour, and that one is about Henry Osterman. He was the first field secretary for the Lincoln Highway Association. And he also helped the U.S. Army with convoys up and down the East Coast. So in 1918, he had this idea World War I was getting over with, and he had an idea to take Army vehicles across the United States and kind of show them off to the people and test the roads at the same time. So he combined his military experience with his Lincoln Highway experience, and that's where the 1919 Army Convoy came about, which was celebrated last year in 2019 as two different groups reenacted that convoy and traveled from, they didn't start in New York, but they started at Washington, D.C., out in front of the White House, and then got on the Lincoln Highway at Gettysburg, and then drove all the way across to San Francisco. So they came through Iowa last summer. He, unfortunately, Mr. Osterman, who had this idea, the next year was traveling on the Lincoln Highway, and outside of Montour, Iowa, over by Marshalltown, he was in an auto accident and lost his life. So it's very close to this Maple Hill Cemetery there on the east side of Montour. And we put in an interpretive panel about Mr. Osterman and his life there to memorialize him and his efforts for the Lincoln Highway. So these different panels tell different stories about the Lincoln Highway and the people that helped put it together. And like you said, during a pandemic, you can still drive by and you can get out of your car and go read them and learn a little bit more about the Lincoln Highway.
Well, that is quite a lot. I think I've certainly learned more than I ever knew about the Lincoln Highway today. And your award is really for the whole project. Is that right?
Well, yes. Yeah. So this is the first year they've given this award. We were supposed to have the announcement during the Heartland Byway Conference, which was going to be held in Leavenworth, Kansas in April, but that's now been postponed till October. So they decided to go ahead and make the announcement. We could go back. They're going to give out this award every 2 years. So we could go back to the panels we did in the last 2 years and put those in for nomination. But we did give them information about all the panels that we've created.
Well, it sounds like the whole project is very impressive and worthy. And
yes, we traveled through 43 communities in Iowa, and our goal is to have at least one interpretive panel in each of those towns. So if you're listening and you're from another town, like we have one in Ogden about the footprints that were left in the pavement in 1929 when the Lincoln Highway got paved, and then somebody walked through the wet concrete and left their footprints, and the city never covered those over with any of their road projects. But with traffic and wearing it down, they decided, I think it was in 2017, to cut those out of the pavement and save them and then repave the road. So we did an interpretive panel about that.
And where are these sacred footprints?
It's on Main Street. There is, unfortunately, there was a grocery store right next door to the open park where yes. It was, and the grocery store burnt down.
Yes.
So I raced over there to see the fate of my interpretive panel, and it was still there and things were smoldering, but the footprints are there and the interpretive panel is there.
Well, that sounds like when we can do road trips again, that sounds like a road trip to go see the footprints and see what's happened with that wonderful grocery store, which I guess burned to the ground, right?
It did, yes.
Jan,
yes.
This is Pat Schlarbaum. I'm curious, when they plotted out the road in 1913, gosh, Iowa was probably kind of an outlier, if you will, of a rugged terrain and wet areas. Are there any stories of significant merit that talks about what it was like to get the Lincoln Highway across even this part of Story County, where was previously just dirt roads?
Right. So in 1913, the Lincoln Highway Association figured out where the route would go. And I always thought Iowa was just based on good bridges to get across the Mississippi and the Missouri.
Right, yeah.
But in further reading, it said that they really tried to find the trajectory of getting across the Rocky Mountains. And so that kind of determined how they would go from Chicago to the West. And then once they kind of figured that out, they wanted to find the shortest, best route. So once they determined that, then I think they looked at bridges to get across the Mississippi, which there was a bridge called the Lyons-Fulton Bridge in Clinton, what was the town of Lyons at that time, but now it's part of Clinton. And that bridge is no longer there, but it's at the northern end of the town. And had like a 90-degree angle coming off the bridge. So when this 1919 convoy came through, it was quite a challenge to get down and turned on that bridge. There have been people in the early years that would be the first of this or the first of that to travel the Lincoln Highway. The Van Buren sisters, they were relatives of President Van Buren, and they rode motorcycles across the Lincoln Highway. And said they would have made better time, but they got arrested different places for wearing pants. And then there were people that were Alice Ramsey was one of them that was one of the first women to travel the route. She had a gentleman that was riding the train that would meet her in different towns and would help her. And she had her two sister-in-laws with her, I believe, and they traveled. So they have a book out that tells about their travels. There's people that, you know, rode bicycles across it, people that have walked it. In 2018, we had two gentlemen from, grew up in Jefferson, Iowa, that are retired and decided, they used to do like canoeing trips and things like that. And they decided, well, we'll just go out on an adventure at our age now. And so they walked from Clinton to Council Bluffs along the Lincoln Highway. And I think it took them like a good month and a half or so. But they did stop by my office in Ames as they came through. And they weren't going to tell anybody till they got about halfway through because they weren't sure they were going to complete it. But they did. So that was pretty interesting that people are still enjoying the Lincoln Highway. But there are, Iowa was known for its gumbo. And when it got this time of year, when it was wet and rainy and people would get stuck. And so the Lincoln Highway Association decided that they would do seedling miles in the different states. And Iowa put their seedling mile outside of Cedar Rapids. So they picked the wettest, muddiest, worst place and then put in good pavement so that people could see what a good road looked like. And they paved a mile section there, and people would take horses and drag their cars through the mud out to the good pavement just to drive back and forth. And people would take their chairs out and watch people drive back and forth. Activity of seeing what a good road looked like. And that was to help promote locals in paying for their own good roads, rather than the Lincoln Highway Association had tried to raise funds to pave the whole thing from New York to San Francisco. But you can imagine how expensive that would be. So they thought maybe it would be better if locals did their own work. So then Greene County over by Jefferson was the second area in Iowa to have a paved Lincoln Highway.
Thank you.
I can't resist asking a question. You said the whole Lincoln Highway was paved?
Well, okay, so no. It's not all paved. Back then they called it an all-weather road. So they wanted the road improved enough that it would be travelable in any kind of weather. So there are portions of it that are still gravel.
Like between Ames and Boone. And I thought, I'm going to drive this.
In Western Iowa, we have some gravel area too, between like Missouri Valley and Council Bluffs. Some loops that take you. In fact, there's one that's, I think it's called a Level B road. It's only about maybe a fourth of a mile, but I did drive on that one day. And being the farm girl I was, I figured I could do it. So I did.
Yeah, well, driving after you've just lived in a protected world for many years, to drive on an old gravel road from Ames to Boone, or from County Line Road to downtown Boone, was pretty shocking.
But I think by 1930, Iowa felt like they had the roads improved enough to where you could travel in any kind of weather on the Lincoln Highway. And then as new bridges were formed or built and new roads were built, the Lincoln Highway took different variations. Like the town of State Center had four different routes through it. And that's not a very big town. But it changed over the course of the years. There's different alignments of the Lincoln Highway. For the byway, we've tried to sign it with the best paved areas, historically accurate. And then we have loops that go off of it, but we'll bring you back to the other spine of the byway.
Well, this has been fascinating. You are really the historian of the Lincoln Highway.
Well, it's been fun to learn about it, yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to have you as our guest. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk with hosts Pat Schlarbaum and Susan Franzen. Today's guests were Carolyn Raffensperger, Veronica Fowler, Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald,
and Jan Gammon. Local Talk will not be rebroadcast at noon or 7 p.m. today. At noon today, Local Talk will present a special program from the Ames Public Library called Reading Radio. At 7 p.m., we will have an on-air Pantorium session, which Pat Schlarbaum described earlier. This will be Red's Blues Band playing songs from their new CD.
You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There we'll also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow Become a Member Donor button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.